The Arab-Jewish conflict, the modern Arab-Jewish conflict, has now been going in a continuous war for the past 40 years. Basically, we've been in a state of war with most Arab countries for the past 40 years, with the exception at the moment of Egypt, with whom we have a measure of peace. We're not only at war, we're not only at war with the Arab countries, but we're at war basically with various groups, various terrorist groups that the Hezbollah, PLO. Not only that, but we're also, even Arab countries that do not have any borders with Israel whatsoever. For instance, Iran. Does anyone know what the Iran-Iraq war was called by the Ayatollah Khomeini?
The Holy War.
The Holy War against?
The devil of the world.
Jerusalem. Yes, he called it the war to capture Jerusalem.
Iran-Iraq.
The Iran-Iraq war, yeah. Ultimately, the Ayatollah wanted to eventually march on Jerusalem. But in any case, I just want to point out the extent of the conflict is massive. The cost of the conflict to Israel has been terrible, both in terms of human life, financially. A tremendous percentage of our gross national product goes to military. In addition, it has been the conflict has divided the country very, very radically into extreme rights and extreme lefts. You have, on the one hand, you have certain elements in the left who basically follow the knee-jerk liberal idea, which is that just give up anything you can, just immediately, so that we can get peace. Right? It's what probably represented by the Shalom Achshav, the Peace Now movement. You have, on the other hand, you have extreme right-wing who say, absolutely no negotiation, we won't even think of it, not an inch of the land will be given up, etc. Right? So we have basically a polarization, you have extremes, and in the middle you have just about everything that you can find. As they say, two Jews, three opinions. So, halakhically speaking, we have to consider three basic questions. Two of them really are halakhic, that is, questions in Jewish law, and one is an empirical question. The two questions in Jewish law are, first of all, the land that we have now in the borders of the state of Israel, is this considered Israel from a halachic point of view? Is this legally Israel? For instance, the Golan Heights, Judea and Samaria, the Gaza Strip, 50 miles into Lebanon, for instance, are these areas, either by virtue of biblical boundaries or by virtue of conquest, do they now take on the sanctity of the land of Israel? It's one question. And it's, the second question is obviously related to this, that if it does have the sanctity of the land of Israel, and there are various commandments about the land of Israel, would halacha prevent us from giving up parts of the land of Israel if through doing that we can save human life? What takes precedence here? It's what it boils down to. Those are the two halachic questions. The empirical question is that, yes, let's say halacha has no objection to giving up land. But would giving up land achieve anything? Okay, that's an empirical question, not really a halachic question. We might deal with it if we have time, but it's not really a halachic question. Okay, so as far as the first two questions go, the boundaries of the land of Israel. It would appear that one boundary is definitely undisputed. Right? That is the Mediterranean. Right? The Arabs always refer to that when they say they'll drive us into the sea. And as the chairman of the PLO said about 6 years ago, and we don't mean in ships. Right? So that's one border of the land of Israel. The other border of the land of Israel is, the Torah mentions explicitly, the Jordan River. Jordan River is a border. Now, the Torah also mentioned that there were tribes who lived on the other side of the Jordan. Right? This is what is called in the Torah as a potential land of Israel, right? But it was considered, compared to the actual land of Israel proper on this side of the Jordan, is considered in the book of Joshua 8, it is called Eretz Tameh, an unclean land. In other words, it's not considered the land of Israel proper. Right? But at the very least, there's some discussion about that, but at the absolute very least, the Judea and Samaria areas are certainly part of the historical and biblical land of Israel. There seems to be no question about that. The Midrash, for instance, mentions that there are three areas which, ironically enough, it says that no one has any right to dispute our ownership of. Right? Because those three areas were not conquered by military might, they were not settled, rather they were bought. The three areas are Hebron, which is where the cave of Machpelah, the cave where Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Sarah, Rivka, and Leah are buried, right, was bought by Abraham from the Hittites. He didn't conquer it. He didn't cheat them out of it. He paid, in fact, he was ripped off by them, right, and he paid them an enormous amount of money for it. Hebron, one of the hot spots of the Intifada. Right. The other place the Medrash mentions is called nowadays Nablus, but it's in fact Shechem, and that's the burial place of Joseph, Yosef HaTzadik, which was also bought by the Jewish people. Right? Happens to be next to, right next to the tomb of Joseph, happens to be one next to one of the so-called universities of the West Bank, which is also one of the hotspots of the Intifada. And the third place is the happens to be the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite. You ever heard of that? That's the Temple Mount. That was bought when King David had the land of Israel and decided, with the advice of the prophet Samuel, to establish Jerusalem as the capital. Right, the Mount Moriah, which is where the temple was and where the mosque is, right, was under the control of the Jebusites. And King David bought it from them. Here's money, bought it from them. Right. So these are three areas, ironically enough, that really there should be no dispute about. We bought them, we didn't conquer them, and but they all happen to be in what's the so-called West Bank. Right? They all happen to be Judea and Samaria. But there's no question that biblical... Me, pardon? Well, yes, according to them, yes. it was annexed, but yeah.
So you're saying no dispute today?
There's no dispute from a point of view of halacha, of Jewish law. There's no dispute from the point of view of Jewish law that these areas are certainly part of Israel, have the sanctity of the land of Israel. In fact, most of the events of Genesis took place in those areas. The oldest Jewish settlement in the world is in Hebron. Hebron, the city of Hebron, is the oldest Jewish settlement in the world. Right. There was uncontinued Jewish settlement in Jerusalem. There was continuous Jewish settlement in Jerusalem all through history. In fact, at the beginning of this century, the majority of the population of Jerusalem was Jewish. Right. But... Yeah, I'm saying, even in the beginning of this century, it was Jewish. The majority was Jewish. So we have the biblical boundary certainly includes Judea and Samaria. Now, how far south do they go? So there are references in the Torah to what's called Nachal Mitzrayim, which literally means the Wadi of Egypt. Now, this is not a reference to the Nile, right? Because Nachal, or Wadi, is a river that dries up every now and again, right? The Nile certainly cannot be described as a Wadi or as a Nachal. And the reference, according to most authorities, is to Wadi El Arish, which is also known as Wadi Mitzrayim, which is somewhere along the border of Negev and Sinai. Basically, it means that most of the Sinai Desert was never anyway considered biblical Israel in the first place. In fact, the Torah was specifically given in Sinai, so that it should not be given in any particular land, any particular... land owned by anyone. It was given in a desert, right, so to speak, a place which is not owned by anyone, to show that it doesn't belong to any particular land. Rather, right, it is something which is eternal, transcends geographic borders. But in any case, Sinai is no question, was not part of the land of Israel, and at the moment it's certainly not part of the land of Israel. But biblically speaking, so we have south, we have the Negev, that would include then the Gaza Strip, automatically, right, because it's bounded by the Mediterranean and also by Wadi El Arish. Right, it would also include Judea and Samaria. What about the Golan Heights? Right. Now, as far north, there is a view in the Tosfos, which is a 13th century commentary on the Gemara. Tosfos in Gittin 2a maintains that the northernmost border of Israel only goes to Akko, which is Acre, which is just north of Haifa, believe it or not. Right, and but as far as the Galil goes, it goes certainly past the Kinneret. In fact, there is... evidence, not just evidence, overwhelming archaeological finds in the Golan Heights and in the Galil of Jewish settlements and Jewish synagogues. There are more synagogues, I think, discovered in the Golan Heights than there are in Tel Aviv nowadays. Is that impressive? Yeah, that's impressive, because there are a lot of synagogues in Tel Aviv. But in any case, there's a tremendous amount of Jewish settlement in the Galil and the Golan. However, if it is not part of the biblical boundaries of the land of Israel, that would all be apparently irrelevant. However, Jewish law says that conquest does give a certain amount of sanctity. If a particular area is conquered by the Jewish people under certain conditions, it does acquire a certain sanctity. Not all conquests. For instance, the first conquest of the land of Israel was under Joshua. Right, Joshua conquered the land of Israel in approximately 1353 BCE and basically kicked out the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, etc., none of whom exist anymore. And Maimonides, based on the Gemara in Chulin, Talmud in Chulin 7a, says that the sanctity given by the conquest of Joshua was temporary. Why? Because it was through an act of war. Hence, war can only impose a temporary sanctity, and as soon as it was taken over by the non-Jews, Babylonians, and then the Babylonians, then it was lost. It lost that sanctity. However, he says, there was a second conquest of the land of Israel after the Jews returned from the 70-year exile in Babylon. That was the conquest by Ezra and Nehemiah. And that conquest was a conquest in quotation marks, because it was a peaceful conquest. It was done with the permission of the then ruler of Israel, the Persian emperor, and it was done not against the wishes of any inhabitants of the land, because there were no inhabitants of the land. Right? And basically, Ezra and Nehemiah and the Jews settled Israel peacefully. Maimonides and the Gemara say this, it gave permanent sanctity to all those areas that Ezra settled. There's only one area in the biblical land of Israel that Ezra did not settle, which is part of the Beit She'an Valley, which is just a bit south of the Kinneret. And there's a kibbutz there, Ein Hanatziv. There's a mosaic floor of a synagogue there from the 3rd century, which lists which shows the various borders of the Beit She'an Valley that he left unsanctified. The reason he did that was to have basically a free trade zone for the poor, because there are many agricultural taxes, according to Jewish law, and so he wanted to have a free trade zone for the poor people could go there, set up farms, not have any taxes whatsoever, and be able to work during the Shemitah year or the sabbatical year. But in any case, as far as the conquest of Ezra goes, this gave a permanent sanctity to the land of Israel, with the exception of this small area in the Beit She'an Valley. What about a modern conquest, though? Yeah. Very few, very few. In Babylon, they had an intermarriage problem in Babylon. In Babylon. He told them before they came to Israel to divorce their intermarried spouses. Yeah.
It says in Rashi that the northernmost border is the Euphrates River.
That's one of the extended borders. In other words, I mentioned that on the other side of the Jordan, we have 2.5 tribes who settled, right? So there's what's called a potential of the stretching of the land of Israel in the Messianic time, right, would be, perhaps be to the Euphrates. That would be the outermost border, right? But as far as the mitzvahs, right, there are certain commandments that apply to the land of Israel, the agricultural commandments and the commandments of settlement in the land of Israel, etc., right, do not apply to those areas. Do not apply to those areas. If you go to those areas and set up a farm, none of the agricultural laws of the land of Israel will apply to you. Okay. So that's only a potential. Most authorities I've seen say that that cannot be, because it refers to it as a Nahal. The Nile, there's a specific name for the Nile in the Torah, which is called the Yeor. Look in Exodus, where it describes the plagues, it talks about it, the Yeor is the name in the Bible for the Nile. Nahal also is generally used in the Bible to describe a wadi. That's how it's translated by the Aramaic translations as a wadi. And wadi is unlikely that it would mean the Nile. Very unlikely. Okay, those who do interpret as the Nile also would mean as part of that potential expansion of the land of Israel in the Messianic times. Again, would be a peaceful expansion, because in Messianic times, the prediction is for peace. Right? So it wouldn't be through war in any case. Now, what about a modern conquest? What about a conquest which, let's say, we'd get the desire to conquer Borough Park for some strange reason, and annex that to the state of Israel, right? Let's say, what are the conditions then for a conquest to imbue sanctity of the land of Israel? So basically, it's not automatic. We require four conditions. Four conditions. Number one is that it must be done for a communal purpose. The war must not be a private war. For instance, Ariel Sharon likes a villa in Damascus, right, and says, what the heck? Right. So they're going to Damascus, they could have, right? They're only 20 kilometers from there, right? Let's say they're going to Damascus to get it. That's called a private war. That's not for communal purposes. That wouldn't imbue any sanctity, and it's very questionable whether it would be permitted. Right. So that's number one condition. I would say we fulfilled that. In the 67 war, it was certainly a communal war. It was not for private purposes. Number two is the presence of the Talmud says actually the majority of Jews. We didn't have that. However, most of the commentaries say what is meant is the presence of a quorum of Jews. The quorum, we have different quorums for different purposes. For instance, for a minyan to pray, the quorum is 10. for the presence of the Jewish nation as a whole, the minimum quorum is 600,000. How do we get that figure? That's a figure that came out of Egypt. It's a figure given in the Torah for the army that came out of Egypt. The army of Jews that came out of Egypt was 600,000. Right? So that's considered a base number for the Jewish people, which means a Jewish presence in the land of Israel that would enable us to, let's say, if we conquered something, now it becomes part of the land of Israel according to Jewish law, right, is given by the presence of 600,000 Jews. That we also had in 67. Interesting to note, in 1948, when the state started, there were approximately 600,000 Jews in Israel. Within the next 2 years, about 600,000 Jewish refugees from Arab countries came to Israel and were absorbed by the population of 600,000, given jobs, clothing, housing, and schooling. Right? It's very rare to find it. Of course, this was more. There were more Jewish refugees from Arab countries than Arab refugees from Israel at the time. According to British figures and according to Palestinian figures, right, at the time, numerically, could not have been more than about 440,000 Palestinian refugees leaving the land of Israel in 48. Right? So no one ever talks about the Jewish refugee problem because the Jews took care of it just like that. As soon as they came, they were absorbed. Right? And that's a population absorbing a population of its size. That's usually people forget about the Jewish refugee problem. The Jews who were threatened by pogroms and who were killed and raped, etc., in Arab countries during 1948 and beforehand, people always forget about that. Why? Because we took care of it already. Right? So therefore, there was no problem. Right? No one suffered. Right? Of course, it's not true. People did suffer and required a tremendous amount of hardship on the state of Israel to absorb them. Right? But we were talking about the conquest, right? So we had 600,000 Jews in Israel in 67 without doubt.
But isn't 600,000 only between the ages of 20 and 60 and only
right. That was the army that came out of Egypt. That's considered the base unit because that's the only figure the Torah gives. Okay?
So that you cannot include the children or those over 60 and you're not including the women.
No.
In the figure that you're giving, from these various areas, countries or the various also include people below the age of 20, above the age of 60, and
yeah.
Not women.
I'm aware of Eliezer Voldenberg. Rabbi Voldenberg says that the number of 600,000, despite the fact that originally it meant to include the army, right, whenever later on in Halacha, the base unit of the Jewish people is referred to, it means 600,000, including even those who were not included in that original count. That original count was only for the army. But what they're picking up on is the fact that the only number the Torah mentions is 600,000. Right? So because the only number the Torah mentions is 600,000, when there's a halachic requirement for quorum of the Jewish people, we say 600,000, and we'll include even women and children, people who were not in the army, people over 60 also in that. Right? The third condition is a bit harder to fulfill, apparently. The third condition requires that a prophet, or the Urim V'Tumim, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, which is a form of prophecy, in other words, requires divine agreement to the war. That is to say, right, the Speaker of the Knesset's got to get up, ask Jeremiah, do we go to war? He's got to say, yeah, right, just got a prophecy, it's okay. We have to have divine sanction for that. So the 67 war could be argued, there was no prophets around. Right, at least no one who we authenticated as a prophet, right? And therefore, how could we say that there was divine sanction to the 67 war? Rav Kook and Rav Eliezer Huda Voldenberg, Kook says in a previous response he wasn't alive in 67, but Rav Voldenberg says that any defensive war in the land of Israel is automatically has a divine sanction. To defend yourself is a mitzvah, right? Even if that defense means a preemptive strike. For instance, if you're in an alley in New York, right, and a guy's got a Muslim Power T-shirt on, and he's got his switchblade out, right, and he's walking towards you. A preemptive strike is totally permitted, right? You may break his kneecap, whatever you do, right?
So,
you're right. That's a good point, right? I forgot it was New York. Right? In Australia, you'd have to have that T-shirt on, right? But in any case, so preemptive strike. Now, 67, by all, according to any rule of international law, was certainly defensive. How is it defensive? We fired the first shot, people always ask. However, the fact of the matter is that there was a UN force in Sinai, which when Nasser said, who was meant to guarantee peace, remember this fact for later on, they're meant to guarantee peace, Nasser said to them, oh, look, could you guys leave? And they said, okay, and they left, right? And that was it, that was the guarantee, right? So Nasser moves one of the largest tank forces ever assembled into the Sinai. He makes speeches about driving the Jews into the sea, and about the victory of the Arabs over this foreign influence in their part of the world, right? And they make defense pacts with Syria and Jordan, right? Arab countries who are not bordering Israel, like Iraq, like Yemen, like Saudi Arabia, send massive amounts of troops and aid to Arab countries bordering Israel, right? And they're all massing their troops on the borders of Israel. And then finally, Egypt blockades the Straits of Tehran, which according to international law, according to the Hague Convention, this is an act of war. Blockading a free waterway to any country is an act of war, right? And hence, so now Israel fires the first shot, and this is called the Israeli aggression of 67. Aren't we nasty? Right. Anyway, according to Jewish law, there's no question this would be considered a defensive war, despite the fact we fired the first shot. Right, and if it's a defensive war, then it's divinely sanctioned automatically, because you're allowed to defend. Not only are you allowed to defend yourself, you're obligated, and it's a mitzvah to defend yourself. Hence, it becomes a defensive war, and it becomes divinely sanctioned. The fourth condition is that all the areas, other areas of the land of Israel, proper, be already conquered by Jews before you conquer anywhere else. Like, let's say if Tel Aviv was under Arab rule, chas v'shalom, right? And we would decide to go and conquer Borough Park, right? So under such a situation, the conquest of Borough Park would not bestow any sanctity on it whatsoever. Why? Because we had not yet taken care of the biblical part of the land of Israel. So it so happens, either, as you might say, coincidentally or providentially, the Golan Heights was captured on the last day of the 67 war after we'd already got Judea, Samaria, and Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. Right. So that condition happened to be fulfilled also. Right. So it could be, it appears to be fairly clear, at least according to the opinion of Oldenburg and of Cook, that all the areas which are at the moment under Israeli control, right, are considered part of the boundaries of the land of Israel, and therefore the commandments that apply to the land of Israel apply to them. Now, what are the commandments that apply, assuming that this is all sanctified as far as the land of Israel is concerned, what then are the commandments that apply? So, in Bamidbar, which is Numbers 33, verse 53, we're told, V'irishtam es ha'aretz v'yishavtem ba, you shall inherit the land and dwell in it. Inherit the land and dwell in it. Right. So, there are two parts of this commandment, Nachmanides says. One is to inherit the land. How do you inherit something actively? Well, there's really only one way to do it, is to kill the person you're going to inherit from, right? So inherit here actively means to kick out those people who are in Israel at the time, who are the Canaanites, right? And therefore inherit the land of Israel. So number one, there was an obligation to go to war, and to Joshua to go to war and to conquer the land of Israel. Just to inherit the land of Israel, because there is absolutely no other meaning. The only way because it's given in an active verb. The verb is given in the PL in an active form as a command, rather an imperative. There's an imperative to inherit it. The only way you can inherit something, how do you inherit it? In an active fashion. Well, in addition, the Canaanites were not selling. It was, right, but in addition, what we see is that immediately afterwards, the Jews assemble an army. Right, the Torah itself says, Jews assemble an army, and under Joshua they go into the land of Israel and conquer it. Right? So, that was under the divine command. God tells Joshua to go and conquer. Just to give you a bit of background, we're talking about the Canaanites. Past. Joshua. You know? Okay, so, we're talking about the Canaanites, first of all, the nations that inhabited the land of Israel. Basically, if you look at descriptions of the Canaanites, both from archaeology and from the Torah, they're basically about the moral equivalent of Nazis. The Canaanites practiced child sacrifice. They practiced a justice system, which meant if you gave charity, you'd get killed for it. They basically had, in most of the Canaanite cities, there was no justice system whatsoever. It was total anarchy. Right? And they also were, aside from all this, they were pagans. They believed in the only thing they believed in basically was violence and immorality. And hence, we talk about the Canaanites. We're not talking about a bunch of nice people who just happened to be living in the next neighborhood and you moved your cannon into the front yard and blew them away. Right?
So it also says that clearly, you commanded that you shall go in and that you shall drive out the Canaanite, the Jebusite,
I'm getting to that. I'm mentioning the various commandments that are involved in the land of Israel. That's in Deuteronomy 7, right? But it basically in Numbers 33, what we have are two things. Number one is to inherit the land of Israel, to take possession. You're right. You also fulfill that mitzvah by buying it. Right? You fulfill that mitzvah by buying land also. Right? The only way to do it then was by war. But, so we have one thing is to inherit it, positive commandment apparently according to Nachmanides. Second, to dwell in the land of Israel, Yishuv of Eretz Israel, to live in the land of Israel. Those two things would apply, right, to all those lands that I've been describing so far.
Is it also possible to say when you talk about the present that you don't know exactly what thing and how it is like, but even if it's past,
we know from the oral law that it means to take possession of the land of Israel in whatever way you can. That's part of the tradition we have of that, and that's what we see from the Torah itself, even without the oral law. Right. So we have, but the more important mitzvah that we would have to apply in the situation of giving up land, for instance, for peace, would be what you mentioned, which is Lo Sechonaim, which is Deuteronomy 7, where the Torah says, right, behold, I've given before you the land, right, come in and conquer the land, and these nations will fall away before you. You'll take possession of the lands. Loi tikrois bris, right? Do not make a covenant with them. Veloi sechonaim, and do not give them lo sechonaim is interpreted by the Gemara in Avodah Zorah as meaning do not give them the ability to live in the land. Right? You're not allowed to give. The oral law interprets this as a prohibition to give or to sell land in the land of Israel to a non-Jew. Right. Now, specifically, a non-Jew who is talking about a non-Jew who is not a monotheist and who does not accept Jewish rule. A non-Jew who is a monotheist, an ethical monotheist, accepts the Noahide laws and accepts Jewish rule, has the right to live in the land of Israel and must be supported by the social structure of the Jewish state according to Jewish law. No, he's a Jew. He's still under Jewish law, even though he doesn't practice it. No, we're talking about a non-Jew, right? It's just that amongst non-Jews, there's a division, right? A non-Jew who's an ethical monotheist, right? Let's say you have a Muslim, a believing, good Muslim, who accepts Jewish rule in the land of Israel, he would have halachically have the right to live here, right? Of course, if you had a Zoroastrian, right, who was coming in with his goat's entrails and wants to make aliyah to the land of Israel, you would not be allowed to let him. Right, because he's a pagan. Right? Now, however, the prohibition of selling or giving land applies to any non-Jew. Right, the prohibition. Now, the question here is this: supposing we know we have a clash here, right? Apparently, before we get to assuming that the empirical question is solved, assuming that giving up land would save human life, then we have a clash. On the one hand, we have a prohibition. We have a prohibition of giving land to a non-Jew or selling land to a non-Jew in the land of Israel. And also, we have a positive obligation to inherit land, to actually take possession of the land. Right? On the other hand, we have human life. Right? Now, what basically it boils down to is, according to Jewish law, what takes precedence? Now, we know that in general, in Jewish law, we have the idea of the Chai Bahem, which is, these are the statutes of the law. These are the Torah says that these are the statutes of the law. And these are the statutes of God in Leviticus 18, 5, Vayikra Yudches Hay, right, where the Torah says, Ela achukas v'amishpodim shenasadilhem v'chai v'ashayase oisam ha'adam, that a man shall do them, v'chai b'hem, and live by them. The oral law understands this as being an exemption in any case of danger to life for all the commandments except for three. That's to say, any commandment is waived in case of danger to life. If a person has to eat on Yom Kippur, it is a mitzvah to eat. If there's any slight danger to your life, you must eat. Story goes that in Vilna 200 years ago, the rabbi, very famous rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the story is told that there was an epidemic, I think it was a cholera epidemic in Vilna, and in order to have sufficient resistance, right, not to fall prey to the epidemic, you would have to eat. As even if you weren't sick yet, but you still have to. He said you still have to eat on Yom Kippur because the doctor said it was important to be strong and to have sufficient resistance. Story goes that he got up and he heard that there were still people who balked at eating on Yom Kippur. I'm not even sick yet, right. So he got up in shul on the pulpit, right? And he wasn't Reconstructionist or a humanist rabbi. He was this Orthodox. He's in Vilna 200 years ago, right? I mean, this is like, this is heavy stuff, right? He gets up on the bima, right? He makes kiddush and he eats, right? To show people that it's a mitzvah, just as it's a mitzvah to fast on Yom Kippur, when there's danger to life, it's a mitzvah to eat. And also on Shabbos, right? Just as it's a mitzvah to keep Shabbos, if there's any, even a slight danger to life on Shabbos, it's a mitzvah to do whatever you have to do on Shabbos. Okay, that's clear in Jewish law. There's only three exceptions given in the Jewish law, the Gemara Sanhedrin. Right, the Gemara Sanhedrin says three exceptions. One exception is idolatry. One must give up one's life rather than worship idols. The other exception is incest. I'm going to come to a clash between land and law of the third party. If someone says to X, I'm going to kill you unless you kill so-and-so, he's not allowed to kill the third party. Right. So, except with the exception of those three, it is a major rule in Jewish law, that v'chai behem, you shall live by them, that the statutes of the Torah are given to live by them, that means when they clash with life, life takes precedence. It would appear from that, to be very clear cut, right, that therefore, if it's going to come to a clash between land and life, life takes precedence. Because the possession of the land of Israel is not one of those commandments that is listed as an exception. There are some authorities who object to this. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, for instance, famous halachic authority, maintains that because the initial commandment to take possession of the land of Israel was involved with a war. Right? What was the commandment? It was a war, to go to war. And he says war is intrinsically dangerous, right? Unless you're in the National Guard in Iowa, war is usually dangerous, right? And probably most of you have forgotten about that problem. But in any case, war is intrinsically dangerous, and if there's a command to go to war, that means part of the command is to put yourself in danger. Right? When is there an exception? This would be an exception to the rule. In any commandment where there's no intrinsic danger in performance of the commandment, then obviously God did not put that commandment in place of life. And when life clashes with the commandment, life takes precedent. But supposing God gives you a commandment which is intrinsically dangerous, then obviously there's no exemption of danger to life, because he said put yourself in danger. That's part of the commandment. For instance, right, if he says to Joshua, go to war against the land of Israel, would it be logical for Joshua to say, well, I'm exempted from that mitzvah because it's danger to life? No, because that is the command from God, to go to war, to put yourself in danger. Okay. That's the argument of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. It's also the argument, one of the arguments of Gush Emunim, one of the right-wing movements, and it's also the argument of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. There are a number of objections to this argument. One objection to the argument is the view of Maimonides. The view of Maimonides is that mitzvah to go to war is perhaps what you're alluding to, but the view of Maimonides is that mitzvah to go to war to conquer the land of Israel was a one-shot mitzvah. The one-shot mitzvah. At the time of Joshua, there was such a commandment. During the rest of history, right, until Messianic times, according to the Megillat Esther's view of Maimonides, you'll find this in Mitzvah 4 of the book of Nachmanides, correct, the emendations on Maimonides' Book of the Commandments, if you're interested. I don't know, it's not in English anyway. But here he says, Megillat Esther says, in his commentary on Maimonides, that Maimonides maintains that this is a one-shot commandment, which means that the commandment for the rest of time is nothing to do with, there's no danger involved. No, that is to say, settle in Israel, don't sell Israel, right? Because those two commandments are not intrinsically involved with danger, therefore, it is in the place where they clash with human life takes precedence. That's one objection. Second objection is that the code of Jewish law would appear not to agree with this reasoning of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and Lubavitcher Rebbe. Because the code of Jewish law, this is in Evan HaEzer, right? We find in, according to Jewish divorce law, there are certain times when it's automatically, one can force the spouse, either spouse can force a divorce. So one of them is, for instance, they're living in a situation which is very dangerous, they're living in a very, very poor and very low standard of life, very low standard of living. And one of the spouses wants to move to somewhere which is objectively better. Let's say they're living in Brownsville or Soweto, wherever. And
Beirut,
right? Okay. Let's say they're living in Beirut. Okay. And they want, and one of the partners in the marriage wants to move to Beverly Hills. Okay. And I don't know if Beverly Hills is better. But they want to move to, there's different dangers there, but they want to move to Lawrence, Long Island. So nice, you know, nice peaceful community, right? Nice shul there, right? Want to move to Lawrence, Long Island. And the other spouse objects, right? So they can sue for divorce in such a case. I mean, to keep in conditions in Beirut, right, when it's objectively better there, can't do. Now, there's another case, the Talmud says, which is moving to the land of Israel. One of the spouses all things being equal, wants to move to the land of Israel, the land of Israel is always considered objectively better. Right? But the code of Jewish law says, and most halachic authorities agree with this, based on the Tosfos in Ksuvos 111, and in the Evin HaEzer, that most halachic authorities agree with this, that's only in the case where there's no danger to life in living in Israel. But if there's danger to life in living in Israel, then this doesn't apply, which means they understand that the mitzvah of living in Israel is not intrinsically bound up with danger, and hence it is waived in the case of danger to life. Now that means where the danger is worse in Israel than outside of Israel. I remember I was at a Sholem Zocher, a kiddush for someone who had a boy, and I came in a bit late, and there was a guy in the middle of a conversation, an American accent, and he was saying how he was not able to get to the airport. He had to arrange a flight during the day, because at night he just couldn't drive to the airport because there were stonings and there was Molotov cocktails and there were tire burnings. Right? I immediately assumed that the guy must live on the West Bank. Right? And he couldn't make it to Ben Gurion Airport because there was the Intifada going on. Now I found out at the end of the conversation he actually lived in North Miami Beach. Right? And he couldn't make it to the airport because just after this, a black policeman killed a Puerto Rican. Right? So there were stonings and there was tire burnings and there was etc. Right? But it's... yeah. No. Because that was the one-shot specific command to keep the land. There was a 14-year conquest.
15 years later.
Right. And I don't mean. If someone attacks them, then you have the right of self-defense. You have a mitzvah of self-defense. Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes. Absolutely correct, right? It's exactly what the code of Jewish law seems to be implying. That's exactly what this idea of V'chaybehem seems to be implying. That if it would come to that after you've conquered the land of Israel, right, but you're in a situation, a no-win situation, there's a clash between life and the land of Israel, you would be allowed to give up part of the land of Israel in order to gain benefit of human life. Right. It would have seemed to imply from these sources. There's another source. There's a case in the Gemara Gittin in the time of the siege of Jerusalem under the Romans. Right. So the Roman general was besieging it. Was Vespasian. Right. And he's in his camp. And in Jerusalem there were two groups. There were two groups of Jews in Gittin 56. There were two groups of Jews in Jerusalem. There were the Pharisees, which is the bulk of the population. Basically the rabbis of the Talmud. Right. The leader of them was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And you also had the what's called the Zealots, or the Birionim, right? What Josephus calls the Sicarii, right? The people of the short swords. Right? These are the people who are on Masada also. Now, there was a fight between the Sicarii and the Pharisees. The Sicarii said, we have to fight to the last man. We have not got the right to give up an inch of Jerusalem to the Romans. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai wanted to sue for surrender and make terms with the Romans, not fight. So, in fact, the Sicarii started to burn the grain stores in Jerusalem in order to force people to fight. Right. Now, what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did was that he put out rumors that he was sick, and then his students put out rumors that he was dead, and they faked his death. They took him out. There was a truce during the siege in which they were allowed to take out coffins to bury people. They took him out of the city walls. He escaped from Jerusalem and made it to the Roman camp. The sentries catch him, bring him to the commander. And he says to the commander, Hail Caesar. The commander says, oh, well, you're dead meat, man. Right? He says, why? He says, because the Caesar's still alive. If the Caesar's still alive, you call me Caesar, that means you have just rebelled against Caesar, so I have to kill you. Right? Just then, a messenger walks in and says, we just got word from Rome that Caesar died, you've been appointed new Caesar. So he says, ooh, what? So he's impressed, right? So he's got to take him on as a stockbroker. But He says to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, now what is your request? What is your request? Okay, what did you come for? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, I have within my ability to negotiate surrender of the Jews in Jerusalem. Right? And I have three conditions for that. Three conditions are that you preserve Yavna, the city of Yavna, where the Sanhedrin was, where the high court was, and which was the center of the teachings of the oral law, which the Romans didn't know, but that was where Bar Kokhba was going to come from, and that was where the Mishnah was going to come from, and etc. But in any case, he said, oh, he agreed to that. He said, also I want you to preserve the Davidic lineage. Don't kill off the family of which is probably something that the Romans would have wanted to do, because Davidic lineage would create problems. They said, don't kill them off. And he also said, send medical aid for a certain people in Jerusalem. So the Romans agreed to this, and he gave up, surrendered Jerusalem. So some say that it appeared to be a similar type of dispute. The zealots there were of the better dead than red view, right? And Yochanan ben Zakkai was of the view of the better red than dead. Now, it was not the better red than dead, but he was prepared to surrender, right? And he was prepared to give up land. He did not believe that he did not believe that the land, or even Jerusalem, he did not believe to be an absolute value that would go above the saving of life. He was prepared to give it up to save life. This can be argued with. This proof can be argued with. Some say, but he was backed into a corner. He had no choice. Yeah.
Was that considered a mistake later that he should have asked for Jerusalem to be saved?
Some say that, yeah. Some say that. That it was considered a mistake. Right? But the objection is not because there was an intrinsic value in the land, so to speak. It was because they felt that he could have got more from the Romans and he didn't. Right? Not in other words, he didn't bargain well enough. Right? But the actual bargaining, the negotiation, was not considered a sin. Right? That was considered okay. Right? Basically what I've been giving is very much the view of Rav Shach. Right? And he's a scholar in Bnei Brak, who is one of the ideological head of the Degel HaTorah party. Most religious parties, actually, in the last election, voted for negotiations based on these type of ideas. This idea that we believe that life, human life, is more important than land. And if, however, being pragmatic, we have to be pragmatic, right? And we should not be knee-jerk liberals on the one hand. We should not be knee-jerk right-wingers on the other hand. Because the halacha says that, yes, we're willing to give up land, not back up, right? We're willing to give up land for peace. However, we want a good bargain. We don't want to get ripped off, right? Now, and that is leads on to the empirical question. The empirical question is that, let's say that halacha, and this is the opinion of Rav Shach and many other authorities, there are those who dispute this. I mentioned Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, for instance, Lubavitcher Rebbe.
What is it? Rav
Aaron, Aaron. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik is from New York originally. His brother is the head of Yeshiva University. I always think of him as Aaron because my mother-in-law knew them. Mother-in-law and him were friends when they were little kids. She said she always used to meet Aaron on the way back from the bakery. Very nice, polite young man. Now he's Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. He's like the head of Yeshiva University. He's like, you know. She always talks to him as Aaron. But in any case, according to what was said, halacha would not object that if we could get a situation where giving land to whoever it is wants the land, right, would gain us a measure of relief from war, would gain us a certain amount of security, so there would not be a shedding of more blood, right? Halacha not only would have no objection to this, but halacha would say you should do it. However, halacha wants a good bargain. Right? That is to say, we have to be pragmatic about it. Now, and this comes to this leads to the empirical question. There is the PLO, the Palestinians, basically asking, or it appears on the surface, are asking for Judea and Samaria. As in the Palestinian National Charter, which, incidentally, Palestinians in public discussions always say, why are you referring to the Palestinian National Charter? What about our statements in Geneva? So, in which case, you can always say that, fine, show me what statement that Yasser Arafat made in Geneva repudiates anything in the Palestinian National Charter. They've never repudiated anything here, so it's still valid, right? And it's still printed and given out and distributed. This is from the London office of the PLO. 52 Green Street, London, W1. It's still printed and given out by them. They have not repudiated this. So, Palestine, with the boundaries it had during the British Mandate, is an indivisible territorial unit. That doesn't just mean Judea and Samaria, right? What that means is Tel Aviv, Herzliya, or Samar, right? Now, anyone know where the Palestinian National Charter was written and when? When and where?
East Jerusalem,
1964, at the Intercontinental Hotel. Which is just up there, is built by the British and the Jordanians on Jewish graves on Mount Zion, Mount of Olives. Right? But in any case, when the Palestinians were writing this, that they wanted the territories back got by Israeli aggression, were they referring to 1967? That would be very prophetic and very unlikely. They were referring to the rest of Israel, right? And ultimately, they have not repudiated any of this. They still ultimately want that. So, first of all, Article 9, armed struggle is the only way to liberate Palestine. Thus, it is the overall strategy, not merely a tactical phase. Chas v'shalom, no terrorism. God forbid, they had not mentioned terrorism here. Armed struggle, right? Article 10, commando action constitutes the nucleus of the Palestinian Popular Liberation War. Again, God forbid, no mention of terrorism. Yasser Arafat was kind enough to repudiate terrorism, throwing babies out of buildings in Ma'alot, and massacring school children on Tialim, and killing kids in Belgium, except those, you know, those type of commando actions is what he's referring to here, but not terrorism. Okay. Now, so first of all, it's certainly questionable whether it would gain any type of stability as far as the PLO is concerned themselves. But let's forget the PLO for the moment. Supposing the PLO would be happy with Judea and Samaria, and would then go on a national liberation war and take over Jordan, who they hate, King Hussein, more than probably the Israelis. The Black September organization is named after September 1970, when more than 10,000 Palestinians were massacred by King Hussein's troops in Jordan. And you had the situation of Palestinians, terrorists, escaping to Israel, begging for to surrendering to the arms of the Israeli soldiers, very much like the Mozambique War. Right? You've got these people, you've got blacks from Mozambique running to South Africa, right, begging for, excuse the comparison, but I mean, it's a very ironic situation, right? And that was the situation in September 70, right? But, first of all, assuming that we'd get on with the PLO, right, and assuming that the international guarantees would be better than in 67. Remember the international guarantees in 67 I mentioned beforehand? Nasser asked the UN to leave Sinai, and they said, okay, and they left, right? If you see the UN soldiers in the northern borders with Syria, they're only allowed to have 3 bullets per gun. They're not much of a guarantee. They can't really do anything. Right? So we'd have to have some type of guarantee that we'd be satisfied with. I don't know what that would be, but as Kissinger, in one of his few intelligence statements, said, that it is reasonable for Israel to assume that the person who's been trying to kill them for 30 years might also lie. It's reasonable, right? Someone's been trying to kill you, and suddenly he says, okay, forget it. Right, and I guarantee that I won't do anything from now on, just give me this, right? So, I mean, you'd be correct in being skeptical about it, right? There's nothing wrong with being a cynic in an area like that. It's your life, right? In addition, supposing we did get all these international guarantees and the PLO were happy with that, right? What about the other Arab countries? What about Iraq? What about Iran? Would the Hezbollah now stop? Or would the Hezbollah still consider us the running dog of the American imperialist Satan, etc., right? What about the rest of the Arab states which are still in a state of hostility with us? What about Libya? What about Syria, for instance? Has Syria ever said that if we give back Judea and Samaria, that even recognize our existence? Yes, we recognize the existence of the country that's defeated us in 5 wars. No, they haven't even prepared to say that, right? So there haven't even been, from any of the other Arab countries, and the PLO has never actually said that explicitly, right, that from anyone, that even if we do give it back, who's to guarantee peace with all the other Arab countries, right? Even if it only gets it with the PLO. In addition to that, there was Professor Leo Levy here in Jerusalem, told me he was at an international physics conference, teaches solid state physics at Hebrew University. And at the conference, there was a physicist from Saudi Arabia. So they got together, they were talking, right? And Leo Levy asked, what's the opinion in the academic world in Saudi Arabia about the PLO getting a state in Judea and Samaria? And the guy said, Allah forbid. Right? He said, if they would get a state in Judea and Samaria, he said, first of all, we'd have to pour in millions of dollars to make it economically viable. He said, second of all, they'd probably go for Jordan first thing, because 2/3 of the Jordanian population are Palestinians. In addition to that, Jordan was created by the British, total British creation. The Hashemites who rule Jordan are not even from Jordan, right? So the Palestinians, no love lost between the Palestinians and Jordan. And together with the almost 2 million Arabs in Israel, right, and the 2/3 of the Jordanian population, they'd have a vast majority of Jordan would be Palestinian, right? So they'd have this big state, and there'd be basically a revolutionary type of regime that wouldn't be happy about Saudi Arabia, who they'd look at as disgusting capitalists. Right, and they wouldn't be happy, and also Muslim fundamentalism would be a major force also. Right, in Jordan recently, the Muslim fundamentalists got something like 30% of the vote in the recent elections. Not that it's democratic anyway, but they had elections, they got 30% of the vote, the Muslim fundamentalists. This would also be a tremendous destabilizing presence for the rest of the Arab states. Then we have another problem. So we have a few problems. First of all, will the Palestinians be satisfied? According to the Palestinian Charter, no. Second of all, would we rely on international guarantees? From past experience, no. Right? Third, can we rely on their word? Well, as Kissinger said, if they're trying to kill you, they might lie also. Right? Can't rely on that either. Third, we have another problem, which is the Arab other Arab states that don't like us, even the moderates, right? The moderates have still not recognized us. I mean, why are they moderate? They're moderate because they... Well, I don't think sure why, what they did that made them moderate, but in any case, they're called moderates, right? But we still are in a state of war with them, right? And they wouldn't necessarily guarantee peace giving Judea and Samaria to the Palestinians, right? And for the fifth reason, which is that a lot of these Arab states would not be happy about a Palestinian state, because a Palestinian state would be a highly destabilizing influence in the Middle East, in addition to the amount of money it would cost the rest of the Arab states. Then there is a sixth problem. The sixth problem is that that which most people call anti-Zionism is really anti-Semitism. If you want to see some documentation of this, have a look at a book called Why the Jews by Joseph Telushkin and Dennis Prager, where it speaks about anti-Zionism. And in general, attacking Jews in Belgium from our Gudus Yisrael camp, right, is not anti-Zionism, that's anti-Semitism. Or, for instance, when in Uganda, when the plane was hijacked there, the Entebbe hijacking, the people were divided not on the basis of whether they gave to UJA or not, they were divided on the basis of whether they had Jewish-sounding names or not. So they divided all the Jews to that side and all the non-Jews to that side. Did they ask all the Jews if they were Zionists? Did they ask, where do you plan on living the rest of your life? Well, I plan on living in Borough Park. Oh, okay, fine, you can go on the side with the non-Jews. Is that what they did? No. Right? Do they discriminate? Is a little baby who hasn't developed their ideology yet is not necessarily a Zionist. There's an anti-Semitism involved here, well documented in Why the Jews. Another good book I recommend on the subject is by Samuel Katz, and it's called Battleground, Fact and Fantasy in Palestine. And also will give you an idea of the empirical problems here. But basically, the empirical problems aside, Halacha wouldn't object to giving up land. Unfortunately, of course, Halacha, being also pragmatic, recognizes that although we'd be prepared to negotiate, we don't want to be ripped off, right? And hence, you have to be very pragmatic about it, and while we should have a stance which is willing, it's open to negotiations, right, and is open to the idea of the possibility of giving up land, nevertheless, we have to be very pragmatic, we have to do it from a firm position, right, and we have to do it from a position of extreme cynicism. Okay, we have time for some questions. Yeah. Argue with that. I mentioned some of the objections to their view. They're in the minority. I'm mentioning the majority view. The majority of religious parties that so happened were against them. Ravana Soloveitchik and Lubavitcher. Yes, yes. They're more centrist than right. Yeah. What do you mean?
Are you only now mentioning Israeli terrorist activities that somebody wanted to call on that, simply because they never put in the writing that they said?
Like a terrorist activity, like, for instance?
Like, yeah.
Well, give me an example.
Like what?
How do you define terror? The BBC used to, until about 10 years ago, call the PLO terrorists. And Kol Israel used to call the IRA terrorists. Of course, BBC started calling the PLO guerrillas, so the Kol Israel retaliated and we started calling the IRA guerrillas, right? Usually, one of the accepted definitions is of terrorism that I've heard is attacks against civilian targets as civilians, right? Whereas non-terrorist action is attack against a military target. Now, of course, if someone attacks you in the street and you attack them back, is that called terrorism? Self-defense...
It has to be politically motivated.
Not necessarily. Well, I don't know. I think it's a moot point, the definition of it. But I'm just saying the fact of the matter is that although the PLO has said they repudiate terrorism, when they look in the mirror, right, they don't see a terrorist, they see a commando and a freedom fighter, right, and they've never repudiated any article, which I think is of great significance when you think of their mindset and when you think about will they be content with Judea and Samaria.